From the Denker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Election season is upon us, and from now until November 4th, we'll feature periodic interviews with the candidates. Recently, we were joined by the Democratic Party's choice to fill the office of Utah Attorney General Charles Stormont. Today on the program, we're joined by his Republican competitor, current Attorney General Sean Reyes, who's hoping to retain the seat he was appointed to in December after the resignation of John Swallow.
I hear from average citizens, even those who may not agree with particular cases that we're defending, that they appreciate us returning the focus of the office to just being a great law firm. So really, focusing on the law and not politics is one of the ways that we are restoring trust.
A conversation and your top local headlines just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned for a conversation with Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes. But first up, we have these headlines. Utah Governor Gary Herbert is in Washington this week, busy negotiating the final touches of his Healthy Utah plan with the Obama administration. But on Tuesday, the governor told members of the media that Utah has yet to earn the approval of federal officials. For more details, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham.
Back in March of this year, Governor Herbert had just unveiled a Utah solution for Medicaid expansion, one he deemed the Healthy Utah Plan. To highlight the potential benefits of the program, Herbert visited the 4th Street Clinic in downtown Salt Lake, a clinic that specializes in providing care for the homeless and low-income population. During his visit, Herbert hailed his plan as a way to bring federal tax dollars paid by Utahns back to Utah, and in the process give the state the flexibility to offer its own innovations to Medicaid expansion. All the state needs, he said back in March, is the federal government's blessing.
I recognize we need to get some permission and some waivers from the federal government to do this, but I'm optimistic that we can do that.
It's now half a year later, and the governor still hasn't wrangled permission from the Department of Health and Human Services. To date, negotiations have mostly been stuck on a proposed work requirement. But in a conference call with reporters on Tuesday, Herbert said federal officials have made concessions on that point.
It's clear now that both sides understand that part of Healthy Utah would include a benefit to help those who are unemployed, able-bodied, but unemployed, as a benefit not only the health care that they would need and assistance with their health care challenges, but also the opportunity that the state would have to help them get better employment. And both sides agree to that.
As Utah and federal officials continue talks on Healthy Utah, Jennifer Hyvenin of the 4th Street Clinic says no matter how the state decides to expand Medicaid, the clinic and its clientele will benefit immediately.
When people are applying for jobs, when they're looking for housing, your health really is everything. And providing opportunities for that health coverage and that security for people is essential, especially in our patient population where health problems are a major component of people falling into homelessness. Medical bankruptcies in the United States, the majority of those are due to medical catastrophes, and the majority of those people who file have had some form of health insurance. So even that coverage is not giving them quite the financial security needed in order to protect them from personal bankruptcies.
Governor Herbert predicts that Healthy Utah could be finalized in a couple weeks, though how that plan will look is still unclear. For KCPW News, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
Federal authorities say an upscale hotel chain has agreed to pay $2 million to settle allegations that 43 Utah employees working in the country illegally returned to work after they were flagged by an immigration audit and fired. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement says mid-level and lower-level managers at Salt Lake City's Grand America Hotel formed temporary employment agencies to rehire the fired workers. Prosecutors say 43 workers returned to their jobs within days of being fired, using false names and documents. Officials say four hotel managers involved have been fired, and that hotel executives were unaware of the scheme. Messages left with Grand America Hotels and Resorts were not returned on Wednesday. The resort chain owns properties in Wyoming, Arizona, California, Idaho, and Utah, including the Grand America, Salt Lake City's only Five Diamond Hotel. And that does it for our top local headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. This is The Rundown. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. From now until Election Day, November 4th, we are featuring on the program a series of interviews with candidates for office in several Utah races. The office of the Utah Attorney General has been in the spotlight, and not for positive reasons, for some time now. In July, 2 years of investigative work by local, state, and federal officials, the Lieutenant Governor's Office, and the Utah State Legislature culminated in the arrests of former Attorneys General John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff. You can hear more about the scandal involving the former Attorneys General this evening at 7 when KCPW broadcasts a live town hall forum that is being put on by the Salt Lake Tribune. After the eventual resignation of John Swallow in December, Governor Gary Herbert appointed the current Attorney General, Republican Sean Reyes, as Swallow's interim replacement. Reyes, who is running to fulfill the remainder of Swallow's term, is my guest on The Rundown today. Attorney General Sean Reyes, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Roger. I'm excited to be here and spend some time with your listeners.
You know, I mentioned the arrests of the two former attorneys general. Collectively, they're being charged with 21 felonies. Whatever happens as this judicial process unfolds, the office has had its reputation tarnished. What are you doing and what plans do you have to restore public trust in the office of the Utah Attorney General?
Roger, before I answer specifically what we're doing, let me say that I believe public trust is increasing tremendously already. We've had overwhelming positive feedback from the legislature, both Democrats and Republicans, the business community, minority, ethnic, and religious communities, higher education and K-12, law enforcement throughout the state at the federal county levels, mayors, commissioners, judges, lawyers, you name it. And people have said, and most importantly, let me say this, people have said, we feel a lot more confident in what's going on. I hear from citizens every single day, average citizens, even those who may not agree with particular cases that we're defending, that they appreciate us returning the focus of the office to just being a great law firm. Mm-hmm. So really focusing on the law and not politics is one of the ways that we are restoring trust to the office. Second, I think that doing what I said I would do is the most effective way that we've returned public trust to the office. And specifically, let me say, I said I would focus on ethics and integrity, and we have. I called for and commissioned several audits and investigations of our office, including prior conduct of the AGs on some high-profile cases, particularly one case. And in that case, we submitted the results of the investigations to the court to take any actions that they thought were necessary, up to and including even a rehearing of the case. Mm-hmm. I've worked with the state auditor, the legislative auditor general, Department of Human Resource Management, outside investigators to really shine a light on what's good or bad in the office. Reorganized our internal AG ethics committee that reviews internal ethics issues. We've reviewed operations of our civil review committee in the AG's office, which looks at allegations of wrongful conduct with regard to public servants, particularly at the municipal and local level. Created a public corruption investigation team. We've been working for months to implement an internal affairs structure where employees can report conduct, even against management, to lawyers who would not report to management. So whether that's internal or external, we're still working out the details of that. Mm-hmm. But we are and have and continue to train leadership in the entire office on ethics issues, preservation of electronic documents, for instance, conflicts of interest. And so those things are important. Now, let me also emphasize this. I said I would be committed to fighting violent crime and drugs, and we've done that also. In the 9 months since I've been the AG, our office has led the largest human trafficking sting in the history of the state, the largest spice, which is synthetic marijuana, the largest spice bust, and we were part of a team with the DEA, in the largest heroin bust in the history of Utah. Right. So all of those were record cases representing tens of millions of dollars off of the streets, out of the schools, and saving countless lives. At the same time, and I think this is critical, we've increased our efforts to expand resources and reparations to victims who are often overlooked. Mm-hmm. I've been one of the leaders in criminal justice reform, seeking to change sentencing guidelines, expansion of drug courts and rehabilitation rather than incarceration, because our jails are overcrowded and we can't afford that with too many low-level first-time offenders. And I recently hosted attorneys general and top law enforcement officials from 20 U.S. states, 21 states in Mexico and El Salvador to attack jointly the human trafficking, drug, and arms smuggling issues. So again, when I say I'm going to do something, I think the best way to build and restore trust is to make good on that.
I actually have a follow-up on that, which is I'm wondering a little bit about how morale at the AG's office is generally. Have these scandals taken a toll, and what are you doing to address morale, et cetera?
And Roger, before I hit the morale issue, let me finish off with a couple of other things. Another focus for me was attacking child pornography and abuse, and we've done that by increasing resources to our Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. I said I would be really hard on fighting white-collar crime and Ponzi scams and schemes because we lose hundreds of millions to billions of dollars a year in our economy every year. So I created a new markets and fraud division staffed with some of our best lawyers. We filed more antitrust and white-collar cases than ever before, bringing back tens of millions of dollars to the state and victims in those types of cases. We've just filed the second largest Ponzi scheme case in the history of Utah. So again, I think that those are some examples of where we've combined to educate citizens with AARP, for instance, to prevent them from getting ensnared and entrapped and these types of things. And lastly, in all of that, on the law enforcement side, we've been really vigilant about liberties. The ACLU even lauded me earlier for abolishing administrative subpoenas and working to refine some of our laws regarding asset forfeiture, regarding search and seizure. So I'm proud of those things. And I think that's also helped morale internally, because as people view us more positively from the outside, the people in the office feel that and they sense that. Morale was at an all-time low when I arrived. Scores of interviews that we conducted, the common theme was people said they felt like abused animals from years of neglect or abuse. Overall, these are tremendous public servants in my office, and it doesn't take much to really make them happy. But they need the tools and resources to succeed, the recognition and the support to do their jobs. And I think that two things that we've done, I really believe these have boosted morale exponentially. One is compensation and bonuses. We went to the legislature to get funding, and it wasn't easy because, as you noted, they had just spent millions of dollars investigating our office, and several of them had said at the beginning, Sean, we think you're doing a great job, you will do a great job, but you're not going to get any money because of that. Well, we got the largest amount the AG's office had and focused on compensation because we're at such a competitive disadvantage to hire the best talent. And I wanted to make sure that our great rank-and-file lawyers got what they deserved. All of them got a bump, and we even have a bonus component of that. So internally, that helped a tremendous amount.
Sure. And in terms of reforms in structure, is that something that you're focused on as well?
We did. Now, this is something I made all the leaders resign and reapply. You might have heard about that. I wanted them to make their case to me, show me that they were really passionate about leading. In many instances, we changed leadership, not always because they were bad, but it was just time. We had over 100 people interview. We hired the best managers and lawyers, 15 divisions, almost 50 sections, and not by any affirmative action program, but because we made a concerted effort to encourage everyone to apply, including women and minority lawyers, the pool expanded. And in the final tally, I'm pleased to report that women representation and leadership went from the high 20% to 40% now under the Reyes administration. Minorities were non-existent in leadership, and now we have several in key leadership positions. And again, I want to emphasize they're there because they are the most qualified. But when you create an open environment, you get better results. Funny thing is, I was criticized by many within my own party for promoting and elevating so many Democrats. Now, first, I don't know how they even know that. Certainly, it's not part of the equation that I assess. But second, I really don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican or from another planet. If you're going to do the best job, that's what I'm looking at. So I wanted the most committed leaders, and that is a big deal. We've also implemented performance evaluations, which, if you can imagine, we haven't had. How do you promote? How do you discipline? How do you do anything without consistent documentation? 95% of the lawyers are under a Career Service Protection Act, so you can't do anything unless you have proper documentation.
Yeah. You know, I'm realizing that we don't have as much time as I would hope, but actually turning back to the charges of influence peddling by the former attorneys general, how can you insulate the position from what a lot of people see as the corrupting influence of, well, of money in general, but of specifically of money in politics? What can you do to address that?
Sure. Let me add one other thing, and then I'll hit that point because I know our time's running short. We just had a performance review conducted by the state auditor. 31% of our clients are more satisfied under my administration, and that's just in the first year. So when you're talking about public trust, morale, I think that's an important barometer to show that our own clients are feeling the changes. Money in politics, you know, all positions where you campaign are susceptible to some abuse. Let me share a couple of things that we've done to insulate the office. We've drawn a bright line of demarcation between the office and the campaign. I've got two phones, two laptops, two desktops, two staffs office staffs take care of policy. The campaign takes care of that. They don't meet. My campaign's not up at the Capitol, and citizens are not left to wonder if state resources are being used for personal or campaign purposes and can feel more comfortable. Also, on the other side, that donors are not influencing how policy is made. That's left to the office side and the lawyers. I also implemented a rule that we wouldn't take donations from any person or entity being investigated by the office. I mean, it sounds so basic, but given the environment, that's important. And finally, we've scrutinized every donation or possible donation, and we only take ones we feel are from businesses or industries that we've trust, and we've turned down several already.
You know, I was going to say that your Democratic opponent on this program himself said that he wouldn't accept campaign contributions from certain industries. I think check cashing was one of them, payday loan companies. Are there specific industries that you were shying away from because they do show up being investigated by the Attorney General?
You know, the reality is that any individual or business, should they violate the law, is under the AG's purview. So instead of taking a let's focus on particular industries, I think our comprehensive approach is even better, and that is it doesn't matter the industry. There are good and bad actors in every industry, and let's make sure that whoever we're taking the money from are people that we've properly vetted and that we can trust.
Okay. On that same note, Utah is one of just four U.S. states that allows unlimited campaign contributions in statewide races. Do you think that that should be changed?
You know, many people talk about limits like we have in the federal races as being sort of a panacea to insulate the process. We've seen what happens on the federal level on both sides of the aisle. The campaigns just utilize PACs and PICs to bypass limits, and I think it would be the same in the state. I think rather than focusing on limits, although I'm open to discussion on that, is disclosure laws, and I was a supporter of the tighter disclosure laws that were just passed this last session.
Okay, so a little bit more transparency in
absolutely
in reporting. Is there actually, I'm going to leave that given the time and move on to other topics. And I do want to actually touch on some issues where the office has played a role or is playing a role currently in the news. Same-sex marriage, for example. A federal ruling in the Kitchen v. Herbert case overturned Utah's Amendment 3 about 8 months ago. 9 months ago now. You are pursuing appeals to that ruling, but your Democratic opponent disagrees with your actions, saying that money could be better spent on other things, better spent on other priorities of the office. How do you respond to that?
Roger, getting this issue to the Supreme Court is vital for clarity and benefits all the citizens, not just of Utah, but the entire nation. It's why the plaintiffs in the Kitchen case joined our cert petition, because they understand the same thing. We all want a resolution of this and some clarity. It is the Attorney General's duty, regardless of how you feel personally or politically, you can't abandon your responsibility and abdicate your duty by picking and choosing which laws. I've got this notion that if you want to be a policymaker, you should run for the legislature. If you want a veto power, you should run for governor. But if you're going to run for Attorney General, you ought to be ready to stand up and defend the laws, whether you like them or not. So, you know, that's the rule of law, Roger, and without it, I think our society would be lawless, and that's one of the best ways to restore public trust also.
What about the notion that this is a question of constitutionally guaranteed, at the federal level, constitutionally guaranteed rights, and that the state is defending, therefore, a discriminatory statute? How does that play into it, especially this federal versus state constitution clash?
The only resolved issue at the Supreme Court level is what role the federal government has vis-a-vis the states, not what sister states can do with regard to each other. And so there isn't an established legal precedent. There are lots of interpretations, and given the Supreme Court decision in Windsor, I can see why there are various interpretations. They gave very mixed signals in that decision. So I certainly understand why people are advocating for the rights that they are. And I and many of my friends, even on the other side of the aisle, have told me, we understand why you are doing your job and your duty. When I took the oath to support, obey, and defend the laws, that's what it is. Now, if the Supreme Court rules definitively on that, then we will support that ruling.
You know, I want to juxtapose that against something that that your administration has conceivably in the public eye taken a different stance on, which is immigration policy. We've seen Utah laws that attempted to address the status of undocumented immigrants challenged, the concern being that the state really can't grant any special status legally to immigrants. There was another, I think it was HB 497, the so-called Show Me Your Papers law, much of which was struck down by the Supreme Court. Is there a difference between how you address immigration versus how you address same-sex marriage?
Let me answer the specific question, because I think this is a very good illustration of where the Attorney General does not have a duty to defend a law, where it has been conclusively struck down by the Supreme Court, as in this case. And just to give some context, the law that was passed had a number of different provisions that were challenged regarding the state's role and in the exercise of its police power, and whether that overstepped the state's boundaries into the jurisdiction of federal authority with regard to immigration. The judge in that case, Judge Whatups, said he upheld most of the provisions, except for those that had been clearly struck down in an earlier case in Arizona by the United States Supreme Court. The reason we did not appeal that is because the Supreme Court has spoken, and the law is clear on there. That is a night and day difference, actually the opposite of what's going on in the Amendment 3 case, because the Supreme Court has not given a final indication. And in fact, that's why we're all pushing it up to that level.
It sounds like you're describing a sort of collaborative process to seek clarity from the Supreme Court. Is that the idea?
Well, that's how I've always viewed it. I've said that from the very beginning. I think that this is worth an answer. It's such an important question, and it affects so many people and families so very deeply and personally, that the citizens of Utah deserve it, as do the, you know, the people of the United States.
You know, at one point, a federal ruling said, all right, the state of Utah has to uphold the rights that were conferred by marriage to these couples who were married during the window when same-sex marriage was legal in the state. And what I'm referring to is the Evans case. And it has to do with the rights of adoption, rights of visitation, for example, in hospitals. Are you using the same rationale to have appealed that ruling as the Amendment 3 ruling?
Yes. And the reason why our cert petition, our writ for petition of certiorari, covers both of those questions is because we want finality on both of those issues. We feel they're too inextricably intertwined to decide one without the other. And we didn't want the confusion and the misunderstanding to prevail without a final decisive decision from the United States Supreme Court.
You know, I want to turn actually to public lands policy for a second. A law passed by the state legislature and signed by Governor Herbert in 2012 demands that the federal government cede control of federal lands or public lands by the end of this year. My question is, do you intend to act in the courts to try to see that law carried out?
We're evaluating right now our legal options, along with a comprehensive approach, which I believe includes educating, negotiating, and ultimately probably legislating this issue. Our options run from all the way from a direct appeal to the Supreme Court under an original jurisdiction theory to an injunction at the trial level, where you would build evidence of the harms that have been caused to states and counties, and even potentially having contingency counsel using the model of tobacco litigation to represent the counties or states on a contingency basis so that there's no economic impact immediately to the states. There are lots of different legal theories. There are lots of different potential vehicles and avenues to bring those theories. We're not committed to any particular timeline. And I just testified to a joint committee of the legislature that we are committed to evaluate. We have a report coming on the tail of some legislation at the end of the year that will tell us if we were able to transfer public lands, what would that look like? What would be the economic impact? How would the state handle those things? And I think that's an important question. Lawyers know that often you look at the remedies, and those will dictate how cases are pursued. And so, you know, I think if the issue is critical, and 70% of control by the federal government is not fair to the citizens of the state and many other Western states, but it's not a zero-sum game. I think a lot of people try to portray it as one or the other, and nobody that I've talked to wants to rape and pillage the resources here. We want some access to exploration, but we need grazing and conservation, preservation, recreation. So it's a very complicated issue. Our office is committed to evaluating every potential legal option so that if we decide to push forward, that we're ready for that.
Okay, I'm gonna move on to some more kind of personal questions. One is, what initially inspired you to seek this office when you ran against John Swallow in the first place? But then, you know, what's motivating you to continue to seek this office?
Roger, I've always had a strong drive to serve. I served on many nonprofit and for-profit boards during my career, did a lot of nonprofit service, pro bono cases as a lawyer, and I thought this office was too political, and I felt I could do a better job and return it back to hopefully being just one of the finest law offices in the state. My wife also told me, don't complain unless you're willing to do something about it. So that's what had originally really inspired me to try to come and run against my predecessor. Now, what motivates me today? My family motivates me, protecting them from harm, some of the things that I've talked about earlier, saving children from predators, defending Utahns from some pretty dark and dangerous forces out there. My team at the AG office really inspires me, these great, dedicated public servants throughout the office. And the citizens of the state motivate me. We've been to every county, and when we can help and make a difference, the smile or simple thank you that we get from a stranger really keeps us working those 70, 80, 90-hour weeks that we've put in. I mean, we really have been putting the pedal to the metal from the very outset of my administration.
Finally today, Sean Reyes, tell us something about yourself that that hasn't been reported on much, or that maybe people don't know about you as a person.
I'm going to mention this because you and I talked about this a little bit, Roger. I loved studying the Romantic era poets, and this isn't a Romantic era poet, but I actually wrote a whole Shakespearean sonnet cycle for my wife. As she was abroad and I was in college pining away for her. I love Comic-Con, grew up collecting comic books, and I just spoke on a panel on Episode 7, Star Wars, coming up. You know, I'm good with my inner geek, and I'm happy to put it on display. I had scholarship offers for several sports, but I played volleyball in college. I used to be a boxer as a kid and fight in mixed martial arts fights. Grew up in L.A. and Hawaii. Spent the summers working on my grandparents' land out there. People thought that it was really exotic to go for 3 months. There were no sandy beaches, no pretty girls. There were no. It was cows and the FFA.
Well, Attorney General Sean Reyes, I want to thank you for coming in and taking the time to speak with us today.
Roger, thank you so much. I appreciate your time. And can I ask your listeners for their support November 4th? I would love to continue the momentum that we've built up to continue restoring public trust and to just rolling up our sleeves and getting the job done, which is really what this office is all about, and protecting the citizens of Utah.
All right. Thanks again.